Chester Turner already sits on death row for the murders of 10 women committed between 1987 and 1998. He now faces prosecution for 4 additional murders carried out during the same time period.
Chester Duane Turner's depravity prompted police to label him the most prolific serial killer in the history of Los Angeles, a city whose 1980s and 1990s history was stained with violence, rape, and murder. The former pizza delivery man, who was nicknamed Chester the Molester by those in his own South Los Angeles neighborhood, terrorized and killed 13 women, and was responsible for the death of 2 unborn children during a violent 11-year spree. Born in November 1966 in Warren, Arkansas, Turner moved to Los Angeles with his mother, who was said to be strict and controlling. When he dropped out of Locke High School, he already portrayed himself as a gang member, despite earning money from making pizzas and delivering food. By the time he was 17, he was known to police after a series of low-level criminal incidents. Signs of the brutal nature that would dominate his life had also emerged with the knifing of a childhood friend after a weapon had been pulled on him. Then, 8 months before his 21st birthday, Turner killed for the first time, strangling 21-year-old Diane Johnson and leaving her partially naked body in a roadway construction area next to the Harbor Freeway in March 1987. The fuse had been lit on his murderous tendencies. Bobby Grace, who was co-prosecutor in the case against Turner, has a vivid impression of the first time he saw the killer in court.
I was amazed by the enormity of his very large man. And so that's the first thing that just like reaches out and grabs you. It's like, wow, it's a really big guy. A lot of people would say, well, how could this guy get away with killing all these women? Didn't they fight back? But as soon as you see him, you immediately say, well, he could easily overpower one person, two person, three persons. He's just a really big guy. His physicality just strikes you in the courtroom.
Within 7 months of killing Diane Johnson, Turner made 26-year-old Annette Ernest his next victim, physically overpowering her, strangling her, and leaving her partially clothed body in the dirt on the corner of Grand Avenue and 106th Street. 2 years later, in 1989, he killed Anita Fishman, 31, leaving her body in an alley off Figueroa Street, and 27-year-old Regina Washington, who was 6 months pregnant. The death of baby Washington was attributed to the strangulation of her mother, whose body was found in a garage behind a vacant residence also off Figueroa Street. Despite the repeated modus operandi of strangulation and the general location of the dump bodies, Los Angeles police were no closer to catching the killer in a city staggering through one of its most violent periods. Turner's brutal reign came at a time when city police were facing more than 1,000 murders a year, and, according to some, they had little sympathy for many of the victims. And neither did the media, who relegated stories to the fringes of print and left them off TV bulletins altogether. Margaret Prescott, who founded advocacy group Black Coalition Fighting Back Serial Murders in 1986, is appalled by the attitude of authorities to the killing of so many young black women, portrayed as drug-addicted prostitutes.
First of all, not all of the women were on drugs. Not all of the women were sex workers or prostitutes. And our point is, this is some mother's daughter. This is some father's child. They just can't be reduced to a statistic or to a stereotype. This is a human life. And we said, every life is of value. Black women's lives count. That was our slogan. This was decades before the Black Lives Matter movement. But we knew that there was a connection there. Several of us were mothers. I'm a mom. And when we went around into the community and we let people know what was going on, and the women in particular were shocked because they had never heard about it. They said, well, I feel like a sitting duck. I'm out at night. You know, maybe I'm working a night shift or, you know, some such. And I'm vulnerable. So why am I not being warned about this? Why am I not being told about this? So the community got pretty outraged with how the whole entire thing was being handled by law enforcement as well as city officials.
In this climate of fear around 1992, Turner became a father during a turbulent relationship with Felicia Collier. They fought constantly, and during one particularly violent confrontation, a relative of Collier shot Turner. It made little difference to his raging mind, and during the same year, he claimed his 6th, 7th, and 8th victims. 32-year-old Deborah Williams was left at the bottom of the boiler room stairwell at 97th Street Elementary School, and Mary Edwards from Oklahoma was found in a motel carport off an alley near the same school. Tammy Christmas was another victim of Turner's brutality, her body left next to a portable classroom. Under the weight of murders and a desperation to close the book on their mounting cases, police pinned the murders of Tammy Christmas, Mary Edwards, and Deborah Williams on mentally disabled janitor David Allen Jones. Barely literate, Jones was interrogated by police 3 times over 2 days and repeatedly denied murdering the women. But when he admitted he had fought with the women, he was charged, prosecuted, and sent to jail.
There were almost 70 African-American women who were killed during this time period, during the 1980s, early 1990s. And at that time, there was, within the African-American community in Los Angeles, there was kind of a hysteria for all of these women to be killed, you know, in that area during that time period. There was a lot of discussion, a lot of urban myths that kind of sprung up. A lot of people saying that it was one white guy that was driving around killing these women, but it turned out to there was multiple killers, African-American men who were responsible for these murders.
Turner's next victim, 29-year-old Andrea Triplett, was strangled and left partially naked behind a vacant building on Figueroa Street in April 1993. She was also found to be carrying an unborn child. At a wake following her funeral, Turner joined mourners, eating food and mingling with neighbors unaware of his crimes. The following month, Desiree Jones, 29, was found strangled and dumped next to a vacant residence. When the body of 31-year-old Natalie Price was found partially naked in February 1995, Turner had claimed 10 women in a stretch of just a few blocks around Figueroa Street. He had continued to live and murder in the same neighborhood for 8 years without raising the slightest suspicion with local residents or authorities.
He grew up in the area, so he knew the area really well. And because he grew up in the area, he knew that during the 1980s and early 1990s, there was an epidemic of crack in South Central Los Angeles, and that a lot of people, including poor women, African-American women who lived in that area, were addicted to crack cocaine. And so he used that as a way of luring women into, for lack of a better word, intimate situations where he could ply them with the offer of drugs. And in that time, he would get them in a position where he could kill them.
While Turner had not been identified as a killer, between 1995 and 2002, he was jailed 7 times, on 6 occasions for nonviolent offenses, and once for an assault on an officer and cruelty to an animal. All the time, he continued to kill. In November 1996, he strangled Mildred Beasley and dumped her body in bushes alongside the 110 freeway. In February 1998, Turner's killing of 24-year-old Paula Vance at a tool store in Azusa was caught on camera, which might have brought an end to his killing. But while the sordid detail of the brutal rape and murder of Vance, a mentally ill transient, was replayed on grainy security vision, Turner could not be identified and so remained a hidden menace. In April 1998, he committed his last known murder when he strangled 39-year-old Brenda Breeze in a portable bathroom near Little Tokyo, just 50 yards from the Regal Hotel where Chester Turner was staying. In a brutal 11-year period, he had abused, raped, strangled, and killed 13 women, and ended the lives of 2 unborn children, without ever being suspected of the murderous reign. Despite his brushes with the law and his registration as a sex offender for lewd conduct in 2000, he worked as a security guard at the Midnight Mission as part of a drug rehabilitation program. Had it not been for the bravery of Maria Martinez, a recovering drug addict, Turner might never have been convicted of his depravity and murder. It was St. Patrick's Day in 2002 when he attacked and raped Martinez, who he knew from the mission. He had called her over and asked for a light before grabbing her by the throat and pulling her behind a dumpster where she was raped. At first, Martinez's claims were dismissed by police as just another wild story, but on the urging of an administrator at the mission, Martinez filed a police report and was given a sexual assault examination, which produced the genetic evidence linking Turner to the rape. Much worse was to follow for Turner when in September 2003, while serving time for the rape, his DNA was matched with semen found in Paula Vance and Mildred Beasley. Eventually, the DNA evidence laid bare Chester Turner's flagrant killings.
Chester Turner could be responsible for multiple other murders, kind of similar to Lonnie Franklin. And what happened at, during the 1990s, a number of sex kits that the LAPD had collected on murder cases were destroyed by their department inadvertently. And so we know for a fact that there are several other murders that occurred during the time period, the same time period of when these killings occurred, that fit the Chester Turner profile, if you will. But we can't prove it because we don't have the DNA evidence.
Ultimately, Chester Dwayne Turner was sentenced to death for his heinous crimes. And David Allen Jones, who served 11 years behind bars wrongly accused of three murders, received $720,000 compensation. In Turner's wake, he had left shattered families and destroyed many more lives than the 15 attributed to his crimes.
I think everybody that ever gets involved in these serial murder cases, you are just faced with the enormity of grief that the victims had to deal with. So many different families and the ripple effect, if you will. I know I specifically used a photograph of a ripple in a pool to illustrate, you know, how many different generations of people were affected by Mr. Turner's killing spree. It affected generations of people and affected them so profoundly. And no more, and it was demonstrated very vividly when we did what is known as the penalty phase in a death penalty case, where the victim's family actually get to talk to the jury and tell the jury how they feel about their loved one's death. And we had so many penalty phase witnesses that ranged from children who were babies at the time that their mothers were killed, and now they were coming into court years later as young women talking about what happened. And then we had older people who were the mothers of the women who were killed. So it was really a very moving and very, for lack of a better word, inspiring, in the sense that you felt like you were part of the justice system that helped to bring this guy to justice, but also kind of give some measure of closure to the family members of the victim. You can't bring back a loved one, but to be part of helping to bring some kind of closure to it is very uplifting.
Joanna Dennehy instilled fear in almost everyone she knew. In the early years of her childhood in the quiet town of Harpenden, Hertfordshire, she was surrounded by a loving family. Yet by the time she turned 13, she was on a path to destruction. After running away from home on several occasions, she was 16 when she left for good with her partner John Treanor, who was 5 years older. In her teenage years, she had two children to Treanor, who endured Dennehy's vicious outbursts. In 2009, he left home with the children after being threatened with a 6-inch blade. Her life would be marked by mental health problems and a history of serious drug and alcohol abuse. She was violent, a pathological liar, and almost immune to the possibility of pain or threats. The life that Joanna Dennehy chose to live would lead to murder. Criminologist Christopher Barry Dee, who has spent a lifetime studying the world's most horrific killers, was the first author to interview Dennehy in prison.
I interviewed Joanna in a communal visiting room. No bars, just a table between us. And, well, I sat with another offender, which was a category B, and then we shifted places, basically, is what happened. She was everything I expected her to be. I've seen some deadly eyes in my time. Kenneth Bianchi had the eyes of a great white shark, black, unblinking. You can feel the evil coming into your head. Joanne Dennehy had a smirk, the deadliest smirk you would ever wish to see and one you would never forget. When I started talking to Joanne Dennehy in prison, it is not so much about small talk. It's about, hello, how are you? How are they feeding you? Hey, why did you kill those people? What was the reason? And she just chatted away for 5 or 6 minutes, and then she leant across the table and looked straight at me, and she just said, killing you would be good for me. And she smirked. I've interviewed face-to-face over 30 serial killers, men and women. I've written to and corresponded with countless more. Amongst them, people like the mass murderer Ronnie DeFeo, the Amityville Horror guy in Greenhaven Correctional Facility, New York. But amongst the whole lot of them, Joanne Dennehy is the most deadliest creature that I've ever come across.
Dennehy's mum, Kathleen, and dad, Kevin, remember a loving daughter who enjoyed playing at the local park and was a good student. She shared a room with her younger sister, Maria, and was said to like dolls and fashionable clothes.
Her parents loved it a bit, so they had her back. She came home drunk, smashed up a £12,000, whatever it was, outhouse, ruined the garden. I mean, they were she was out of control. They couldn't handle it. I mean, it's tragic for them. They're decent, loving people. A younger sister, very intelligent woman, young girl. Joe that went off the rails. Why did Joe go off the rails? Because she got into drugs and fairground workers and booze at the age of 14. That affected her mind.
For two fearful weeks in 2013, Tony Ann Roberts lived under the same roof as Dennehy, who was on the brink of murder.
I'm not scared of many people. I was intimidated by her. I was petrified. Absolutely petrified of that woman. And I'm not many people. Straight away, the eyes, you look into the, it's just fear, there's something about her. So obviously I knew not to really approach her as much, even though I did attempt once. But it's just, when you meet certain people, her, I just went 100%, because I can read people, and normally if I can, but her, it was just fear. Looking in them eyes, I'll never ever forget it.
Dennehy's connection to Roberts was through Kevin Lee, a property developer and landlord. Lee offered Dennehy a room in the same Peterborough house where Roberts and her friend John Chapman were staying.
When she did actually move in, and obviously all of her stuff, she made it known, like, because she had a couple of knives, and you could always, they were always on show. Like, as if she'd done that on purpose. Like, they would, or wherever she was, it was, they were there. Like, and she had like this little knife as well that was always in her back pocket. I don't know, a flick knife, I think they're called. And she always had that as well. So yeah, I was really scared.
When Tony Ann met Joanna Dennehy, she boasted she'd been in prison for 8 years for killing her father, who she claimed had raped her. She also told her housemates that she had killed others, including two people she had run over in a car. None of this was true. Dennehy had actually served a 14-week prison sentence for theft.
Well, February, March 2013, she started working for my landlord, Kev. They could, like, how would you call it? She'd come around knocking, debt collecting and decorating and stuff for him. She'd just come out of jail. At the time, she said it was for killing her stepdad. So obviously I now know that was more intimidating to make us all scared of her and stuff. But she said she'd done time. I think she said she had done 11 years for killing her stepdad, which turned out to be false. She liked putting the intimidating and the fear into people. But everyone believed it because of the way she was and the way she come across and approached people. It's very believable.
One of the other tenants living at the house was 56-year-old John Chapman, a Royal Navy veteran.
Very vulnerable. Very vulnerable. And she latched onto that, obviously, because she's that kind of person. And obviously she sensed that. And then obviously one time they were drinking, and he said something about his money, and he's like, "Are you going to get my money for me on Tuesday, Tony?" And she was like, "No, he's going to start giving me the money. I'm going to start going for him. Who am I to argue? I'm not going to argue with you." I did honestly shut my door and lock my door, and I also put a door stopper on the other side when I was in there.
Despite her serious concerns about what Dennehy was capable of, Roberts could not have imagined just how far her evil flatmate would go.
Yeah, there was something definitely about her. You knew she was capable of many things. And I did think she was capable of hurting someone in a bad way. But then part of me's like, did I really think it could have been as bad as murder? But then, never underestimate anyone.
2 weeks after her first meeting with Dennehy, Tony Ann Roberts moved out, sensing there was trouble ahead. Just how much trouble would become plainly evident within days, as Dennehy, aided by a 7-foot-tall Gary Stretch Richards, turned her criminal intentions into a violent and murderous reality. Lucas Slaboszewski was lured to 11 Rolleston Garth by Dennehy's suggestive text messages.
John Dennehy's first victim was a Polish guy who she met in a shopping mall. And he was thrilled to bits because he was quite a lonely guy in a foreign country. And this quite attractive girl who spoke very well invited him round to her house for a drink, on whatever follows a drink. And he actually telephoned his sister to say, "I've met a beautiful girl, I'm going round her house tonight for a drink." He walked through the door, excited, probably bearing a small gift, and within seconds, she attacked him with a knife. While Gary Stretch, her 6'6" lump of lard with a brain the size of a pea, waited in the next room and watched, in case it went wrong, to hold Slaboszewski down. That was her first murder.
By March 2013, Joanna Dennehy's sadistic urges had been unleashed with the help of a man who'd been bewitched by her wicked and twisted personality.
She had like some spell. It was weird. As soon as guys were around her, they were drawn to her. I really just didn't get it. Like, Leslie was the same. Like, my friend Luke, he was the same. And obviously, I don't know if some of it was fear. Because, like, obviously, I think with John it was fear. With other guys, I think more maybe a bit of a sexual attraction because of the way she spoke and the way she would come up to you and she'd stroke the legs and the things she'd come out with, "Oh, you think I'm beautiful and all this. You want to do this to me?" And it's like, okay, you've got confidence, love, I'll give you that. But they just were drawn into it and I just couldn't get my head around it.
After her vicious attack on Slaboszewski, the killer, Leslie Layton and Gary Stretch Richards, put his body in a domestic bin. It stayed there for days. Dennehy even showed a teenage girl the remains of her first victim before Slaboszewski's body was dumped in a ditch at Thorny Dyke. Over the next 10 days, Dennehy showed no signs of remorse, posing with handcuffs and knives and disturbing photos captured on a mobile phone. On March 29th, 2013, Dennehy turned her murderous intent to her housemate, the vulnerable John Chapman.
I used to do Sunday dinner for him if I weren't cooking in the week. I was like, "New place, come over Sunday dinner," and I couldn't get hold of him. Now, with John, I always knew, even at the house, when I lived at the house, he knew it had been a microwave for the Monday because he would have gone out drinking. And then he just didn't, I couldn't get hold of him. on Order Sunday.
Joanna Dennehy had more than Gary Stretch Richards in her rapture. She found it just as easy to influence Leslie Layton and Robert Moore into helping her dispose of the bodies, and later to evade capture. Dennehy had already been diagnosed with a schizophrenic disorder and would later be found to have paraphilia sadomasochism, a label for those who get sexual arousal in giving and receiving pain. And she had these men in the palm of her hand.
And then Les came round, Leslie. And I was like, let me borrow your phone. I've used all my minutes trying to get hold of John. And he was just really weird, acting weird and sketchy. I didn't think nothing of it. I thought he loved John as much as I did. And I'm like, where's John? I was like, this ain't like him. And then all of a sudden, he put his head in his hand and was like, something crazy's gone on. Something stupid. Now, at this time, I didn't take notice, but there was blood in his fingernails. I didn't think at that point. I was like, tell me, do you know what I mean? I'll help you, mate. Do you know what I mean? I was like, joking around. I was like, you got a girl pregnant? Just, I thought it was something simple, nothing to do with John. And it actually turned out later on that he'd outmoved the body, hadn't he? But he knew then and then when I was asking him, begging him, when I was worried about John, he knew what he'd done.
On Good Friday, March 29th, 2013, she killed again, this time viciously stabbing to death her housemate John Chapman at 38 Byfield in Orton Goldhay. It was later suggested that Dennehy may have been responding in the most extreme manner to landlord Kevin Lee's request to have the harmless and kindly Chapman evicted.
Chapman was one of the lodgers, a down-and-out drunk, but a former Navy veteran. He liked his drink, he was kept himself to himself. Lee wanted Chapman out of the house. He was an unscrupulous landlord. He wouldn't go through the normal eviction process. So he sent Dennehy and the terrifying Stretch in there to shift him out. Dennehy decided that she wanted to kill him. They got him drunk. He fell asleep on his bed. And as he slept, she plunged that knife into him 20 to 30 times.
Kevin Lee, who was married with two children, was another bewitched by the killer, even confessing to his wife Christina that he was having an affair. He would pay for this relationship with his life. Having shown no regard for Slabuschewski or Chapman, Dennehy's killing of Lee at Rolleston Garth reached a new level of depravity.
She lured Kevin Lee to one of his properties for sex. He dressed in a black sequin dress. The minute he put the black sequin dress on, she stabbed him and stabbed him and stabbed him, and they dumped his body into a dike. But with Lee, they posed the body in a certain way where they inserted an object into his rectum for the whole world to see. And the reason why Joe did that was because Lee had a lovely, beautiful, loyal wife and two beautiful children that he always talked about. And Lee was using her as a sex toy. And she thought, I'll degrade you for the whole world to see exactly what you are.
Lee's car was burned and left at Yaxley, south of Peterborough. His body was dumped beside a road in Newborough, almost 20 kilometers away. When a local farmer found the body the next day, Dennehy, with Gary Stretch Richards in tow, had already set her mind on more mayhem. First stopping in Norfolk, they picked up acquaintance Mark Lloyd before driving to Hereford, around 225 kilometers away from Peterborough.
The police are now starting to add the numbers up. They know Dennehy was last seen alive with Kevin Lee, who had been reported missing, and they used CCTV, they used every tracking facility, a kit they've got, and they knew that he would probably go down to the West Country where Gary Stretch had associate friends that he'd been in prison with or he knew. And just as they were more or less closing in, Gary Stretch, another man, and Dennehy went cruising in broad daylight for a victim. And they found a man walking a dog. She got out of the car, she was drunk. She walked up behind him and stabbed him 40 times. 7 minutes later, she attacked another man walking a dog, stabbed him multiple times. And then she took the dog and they tried to escape.
Minutes after leaving John Rogers and Robin Bariza clinging to life, Joanna Dennehy's terrifying rampage at last came to an end when police swooped.
There is some suggestion, rumours or allegations going around that she and Stretch wanted to be the next Bonnie and Clyde. I don't buy it at all. I think if she'd had reached the number of victims that Bonnie and Clyde had killed, she would have gone on killing and on killing and on killing. Killers don't stop because they've reached a specific number. So although Denny might have said to police or somebody else, we wanted to be the next Bonnie and Clyde, that is not the way a serial killer works.
Dennehy was charged with the murders of Lucas Slabuszewski, John Chapman, and Kevin Lee. Three counts of preventing the lawful and decent burial of a body, and the attempted murders of John Rogers and Robin Bariza. When she stood in the dock at the Old Bailey, Dennehy performed a final defiant act by pleading guilty.
All serial killers, as far as I'm concerned, like to regain some sort of control. They are power freaks. And Dennehy was now against the system. And she thought to herself, well, if Stretch and these other idiots that I've worked with want to plead not guilty, I'll stick two fingers up to the judge. I'll tell him to F off. And that's what she did. She just didn't care. She knew that she was going to get a life sentence. She didn't go to court to try to beg or use mitigation. She stuck two fingers up at the criminal justice system and to the police. As a result of that, she'll never be released from prison. The only time Joanna will get out of prison is in a pine box.
Gary Stretch Richards, Leslie Layton, and Robert Moore were all convicted of assisting in the crimes. During sentencing, Mr. Justice Spencer described Dennehy's motivation as gratifying her own lust for blood. The severity of her crimes were reflected in the punishment when she became only the third British woman, after child killers Rose West and Myra Hindley, to be sentenced to a whole life order that meant she would never be released. Tony Ann Roberts is still haunted by the time she spent with a killer and the events of 2013.
Why? Why, John? Why Lucas? Why any of them? There's other ways to let someone know that they've hurt you or humiliated you, not take their life. Leslie, I really want to know why, because he was John's friend. He was my friend. It still affects my life. It's only recently that I've started going out and on my own. I won't go out on my own for a long time afterwards. 100% I wish that I'd spoke up sooner, because I think maybe I could have saved John. I could have stopped that from happening. I think there was no saving Kev, because she killed him for different reasons, for humiliating her. But I think I could have saved John. And I think that maybe that's the closure I need. Maybe speaking to her and Les is the closure that I need. I don't know, but I do want to see her, and I do want to ask her why. But I know I'm not going to get a response. She'll just try and humiliate me, and she'll make a joke of it like she always makes a sick joke of everything.
The madness of Joanna Dennehy did not end with her conviction and incarceration.
Joanna Dennehy is the daughter of Satan. When she was first admitted to HMP Bronsfield in Kent, a prison there, which is a privately run prison, she was put in a room next door to another heinous female serial killer, Rose West. She spoke to Rose West for 30 seconds. That night, terrified out of her wits, Rose West was put into segregation and moved to another prison. I've told the authorities that Joanne Dennehy will not stop killing. She has already tried to kill another lesbian girlfriend inmate. She has tried to hack the fingers off of a prison female guard, thinking she could use the fingerprint pads to get out of prison. She's built escape kits. She spent 6 months in solitary confinement. She tried to sue the British government for the inhumane conditions, and the prison have said, if we let her out of solitary, she'll kill. If we keep her in, we get sued. What can we do with her? Joanne Dennehy will kill again.
The North Shore, Sydney, Australia. Who would have thought that for 14 months, this quiet, leafy, affluent area with some of the most spectacular views in the world would become the backdrop for some of the most despicable crimes the country had ever seen? It was 1989. The Granny Killer was on the loose, and the most vulnerable residents were at risk. Originally from Wolverhampton in England, John Wayne Glover was born November 26, 1932, into a working-class family. He was not impressed with his mother having several husbands and lovers. By the age of 14, he left school and started collecting criminal records for petty theft, these records eventually getting him kicked out of the British Army. In his mid-20s and without any qualifications, Glover migrated to Australia, first living in Melbourne, where he was convicted of assault on a woman and several counts of larceny. After moving to Sydney, he added another theft charge to his belt before marrying in 1968. With his new wife unaware of his previous convictions, the man who had become the Granny Killer appeared to lead a very ordinary life for 20 years. Having two daughters and working as a pie salesman, Glover volunteered at the local Senior Citizen Society and was described as trustworthy.
Like with many serial killers, John Wayne Glover's wife, Gay, had no idea that she was married to such a horrific man. Now, we don't know a lot about what happened in their own private life, but we know that once he was caught and arrested and charged and went to trial, that she declared him better off dead. And she moved away. She moved to another country to get away from the case. She never saw him again.
John Wayne Glover's first known murder took place on March 1, 1989. Glover spied 82-year-old Gwendolyn Louise Mitchell Hill walking down the street as he left his usual drinking hole, the Mosman RSL Club. He fetched a hammer from his car and followed her to her Military Road apartment block, where he viciously hit her head and body multiple times before fleeing with $100 from her purse. Neighbors initially thought Ms. Mitchell Hill had had a fall and hosed down the crime scene before police arrived.
He would strike up conversations with some of his victims and even carry their groceries for them to their front doors. He always was prepared to attack when he decided that he'd found the right victim. What made him decide on which victim? I think we will never know that exact answer, but it's something that he did a lot. He kept a hammer in his company car that he would put down the front of his trousers, and when the time was right, he would take out that hammer and smack them over the back of their head, sometimes multiple times. Those that fought and survived the first strike were often hit 2 and 3 times. He took the hammer with him away from the scene and took it home and washed it in acid to remove all traces.
Glover waited just over a week for his next kill, and on March 9th, along the same stretch of road as his first victim, 84-year-old Lady Winifreda Ashton, the widow of famed artist Will Ashton, was attacked on her way home to nearby Raglan Street. Putting up a fight, she eventually succumbed to the strikes of Glover's hammer. As Lady Ashton lay unconscious, he removed her pantyhose and strangled her before taking off with the contents of her purse.
John Wayne Glover made it clear that there was no sexual involvement in any of his victims. But the fact that he took off their pantyhose and their panties in some cases proves that there is a sexual element. This was about degrading these victims. These women were left with legs apart and things like that. It was used to have them look like a weak, defenseless person, and there is a sexual element involved in there. It's not about rape, but it's about the defilement of the poor victim's dead body.
Between his second and third murder victims, Glover assaulted five elderly women, leaving one for dead. Due to the vulnerable nature of these women, he was not identified and left to continue his killing spree. On November 2, 1989, Glover attacked and killed 85-year-old widow Margaret Payhood. She was struck over the head from behind and hit again once she was on the ground. After rearranging her clothing, shoes, and walking stick, he took several hundred dollars from her purse and headed down to the Mosman RSL Club. Again, neighbors were unaware it was a crime scene and washed away any evidence.
The thrill of the chase of taking that cash from his victims was just part and parcel of extending that pleasure that he was getting out of the killings. It wasn't the entire motive. It was more about exacting his own justice against the females in his life that he felt had wronged him. But it was just an enjoyable moment that he had that cash, and people were out there worrying that there was a madman on the loose, and there he was sitting at the local club, putting it through the pokies.
Glover was now losing control, and within 24 hours of killing Mrs. Payhood, 81-year-old Olive Cleveland became his fourth victim. After speaking outside her retirement home, Glover grabbed Mrs. Cleveland and repeatedly pushed her head into the concrete before removing her pantyhose and tying them tightly around her neck. Glover rearranged her clothing, shoes, and walking stick, taking $60 from her handbag. Undeterred by a $200,000 reward on his head, Glover struck again on November 23rd, killing 93-year-old partially deaf and blind Muriel Falconer as she was returning home with her shopping. This time, with the crime scene in her home, investigators were able to collect forensic evidence, including bloody shoe prints. A neighbor described the suspect as middle-aged, portly, and gray-haired, and the reward was increased to $250,000.
When they began investigating the Granny Killer case, there was a lot of people who had seen a young man on a skateboard around the vicinity of the killings. And so he became a focus of the case. Whereas in the second victim's crime scene, they actually found grey hairs on her gloves. Now, had they actually gone a bit further with that clue, they might have been able to identify it being an elderly man sooner rather than later. Because once they actually went through the case and went back to a lot of the witnesses and took the skateboarder out of the scenario, a lot of people said, oh yes, I remember an elderly man with grey hair who struck up conversations with the victims.
6 weeks after the death of Muriel Falconer, Glover's urges became less and less controlled, and he indecently assaulted a woman while doing his usual pie rounds at the Greenwich Retirement Village. Hospital staff recognized him, and although police were yet to link the assault to the murders, they requested he come to the station for an interview. Glover failed to appear. He had attempted suicide and was recovering in hospital.
John Wayne Glover's suicide letter that he wrote actually states that Essie started it. Now, that's his mother-in-law, but he had such a love-hate relationship with his own mother who died of breast cancer. And the fact that he actually got breast cancer later, that conflicted with him too, and he saw that as an effeminate disease and that this sort of emasculated him even further. So there's a lot of these emotions that he has that's been running through his whole entire life. And the fact that his mother, that she had several husbands and everything, and he saw it that it should have been husband and wife and children, whereas she had several husbands. And he just didn't like that. And he felt that men should be in control and women should be seen and not heard. So it was all of this that was going on in his mind about what he saw as what a female should be, and that he used that against his victims, and he used it to sort of exert his own power by murdering his victims so they couldn't speak out against him. They couldn't do anything but be his victim. And it's very much about that role to him, that he now had the power and he decided who lived and who died.
It would take 2 weeks before the suicide note was passed on to the Granny Killer Task Force. But even with the note stating no more grannies, and seemingly to blame Glover's mother-in-law for starting his crime spree, police still had little evidence to bring him in. Glover was put under surveillance, Unfortunately for his last victim, this wasn't enough.
John Wayne Glover's last victim was Joan Sinclair. She was actually younger than all of the others and was a platonic friend of his that he'd had for about 18 months when he killed her. Now, at the time, the police were actually doing surveillance on him and were parked around the corner, but they believed that he was going to go and see his solicitor that day, and so they allowed him to go into that home for many hours, suspecting that any moment he would just come out and probably go to a police station with his lawyer to decide what they were going to do next. After several hours, the police decided that something was up, and so they sent a uniform officer in to knock on the front door just to see what was going on. They used the ruse that there was a barking dog, and just to see if everything was okay. Now, the officer reported that it was silent at the house. They couldn't hear anyone, they couldn't see anyone. So the detectives in charge of the case decided they needed to go in. And that's when they found Joan, and she'd been killed just the same way as the others. The hammer was found, he'd left it there. They knew that John had to be there somewhere, so they went flying through the house. They found his pants on the bed, and then they found him. He'd tried to commit suicide by drinking a bottle of whiskey and taking a whole lot of prescription medications. And he was in the bathtub. He was barely alive, but still breathing. His nose was above the water. He had thrown up in the bath, which had probably saved his life. So they were able to call an ambulance and take him under police guard to hospital, where they were able to interview him later. And he basically confessed then and there. So once they were able to get him talking, he mentioned that the victims looked like his mother-in-law, and that was his reason for killing them.
Over a 14-month period, 57-year-old John Wayne Glover, the cowardly granny killer, had killed 6 elderly women and assaulted at least 6 others.
With serial killers, there's often a point where they tip. And with John Wayne Glover, I think his mother with breast cancer dying was one of those moments. He had a fury that he needed to take out on others, and that's what's happened in this case. This is a killer who felt that his power had been taken away from him because of what had gone on, and so he needed to express that elsewhere.
John Wayne Glover committed suicide in his cell on September 9th, 2005, 15 years after being sentenced to 6 life sentences without the possibility of parole.
John Wayne Glover a coward? Absolutely. Because really, he wanted to kill 2 women in his life. The others were surrogates for that.